Slicer Tangents is brought to you by Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the did we just hit a million order stage and everywhere in between. Sari and Hank, can you name anything that works so well? It's practically magic.
Dragonflies.
Toilets.
What? Yeah, okay. Well, here's one off the top of my head. How about selling with Shopify? Ooh. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and it helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Ooh. Not to mention, it's got award-winning customer support there to help you on your path to success. And those are just a few reasons to love Shopify. But Hank, what does your company, DFTBA, like so much about Shopify?
We've been using Shopify, I think, for over 10 years now, and it really has scaled extremely effectively with us. It is both a huge amount of information at your fingertips, but also in a way that makes it fairly easy to make the decisions you need to make, learn the things you need to learn, and do the things you need to do. It's all in there. And it's one of the great joys of my life is going into the Shopify backend and being like, look at all these people who wanted a thing that I had.
What a rich life you lead indeed.
And if you want to experience great joys like that too, I've got a magic trick for you. Poof. You can now try Shopify for a month for only $1. That's right. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tangents, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/tangents now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in, and experience the little joys of looking at the back end of a store. shopify.com/tangents, all lowercase. Abracadabra.
Hello and welcome to SciShow Tangents, the lightly competitive science knowledge showcase. I'm your host, Hank Green, and joining me this week, as always, is science expert Sari Riley.
Hello.
And our resident everyman, Sam Schultz.
Hello.
When was the last time that you touched a coin?
I picked a penny up off the floor the other day that my cat was playing with.
Yeah, it wasn't so much because you wanted a penny as you wanted that noise to stop happening, huh?
Yeah, and I wanted her to not be the richest cat in the world anymore.
You had to put her in her place.
Yeah.
I was probably a street coin for me, even in these times.
Interesting.
The pandemic, you still pick times, up street coins?
There's something innate within me where I see a street coin and I'm like, I need
so
that.
So you're picking up a street coin more often than you are being handed a coin by a person who is giving you change.
Yes, definitely.
Oh, I haven't gotten change in maybe more than a year, probably. Like, yeah, forever.
I also very rarely touch coins these days, but I've been touching a lot of this coin, which I will show you, the people who are recording with me, and also anyone who's watching on video, which is now an option at youtube.com/scishowtangents. But this is the Crash Course coin, which is available now. Crash Course is a thing that, you know, I think that we all have worked on a little bit, at least.
Not
certainly
me.
Sari and I have a lot. You have. I'm sure you have.
You designed,
I'm sure you've done some Crash Course
set
thing.
Oh, shit.
You designed
You're
organic
right
chemistry.
I worked
organic
on that chemistry
set. That was my life for so long.
Crash Course is a thing that helps a lot of people. And the goal of Crash Course is to make the best content possible at the lowest price possible. When I say the lowest price possible, I don't mean the lowest price we can get away with charging. I mean, the lowest price possible, which is $0. I guess less than that would be paying you to watch it, which we do not do. But
maybe
we
someday
do. Somebody should. But we do make it available for free for everyone because we think that it is a very useful tool to help students and teachers just learn stuff that is hard to learn. And we, I think, do a really good job of that, but it's hard to make work financially. And so every year we do this thing. We sell Crash Course coins, and you can get them at youtube.com/crashcoursecoin. There are two of them. There's the 2,000 learner coin, which allows you to help us reach 2,000 learners. That's $100. And there's the 10,000 learner coin that allows us to reach 10,000 learners. That's $500. And it's stamped with a unique number. You get a little signed thank you card from me and John and a little box we send to you. And We make 500 of them. Last year, we sold out of all 500, and this is how we make Crash Course work. So I'm deeply appreciative of everybody who has gotten or may get a Crash Course coin. If you want to support Crash Course in that way, we really appreciate it. And you can go to crashcoursecoin.com now if you want to do that. So thanks for listening to me talk about it. But I've been touching them a lot, and they're beautiful. This year's back is the art from the cave at Lascaux, which is some of the, you know, oldest cave art out there. And this is part of our story, and we're part of their story. This is a thing I forget. That we are part of those people's story.
Talking about the cave, about it. The cave people?
Those people, who painted those things. Yeah. When Picasso saw it, apparently he said, "We have invented nothing."
I've heard that before, too. It's just like everyone's still trying to draw a gazelle that good.
Yeah, we haven't quite got back to where we were. Yeah. Well, every week here on SciShow Tangents, we get together to try to one-up, amaze, and delight each other with science facts while also trying to stay on topic. Our panelists are playing for glory and also for Hank Bucks, which I will be awarding as we play, and at the end of the episode, one of them will be crowned the winner. Now, as always, we're going to introduce this week's topic with the traditional science poem, this week from Sam.
Okay, so this one's a little bit of a quiz or a call and response, maybe, if you will.
So it's participate, all right. Otherwise you'll be embarrassed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. When the night is cold and you can't see good. Oh, let me hit the thing a little harder so you can know what you're supposed to do.
I think I guessed it already.
Yeah, I think I've got it too.
Oh, well, shut up. just start a fire with some good dry
wood.
Oh, you guys are smart. When talking internal combustion, don't take no sass. What your car needs is good old
gas.
Gas.
When it comes to grilling, you'll never cook in vain if you're feeding your fire with a tank of
propane.
Yeah. If powering a city or state is your goal, you might build a power plant and burn up some
coal.
If you need nuclear power, get this through your cranium. You better get digging and find yourself some
uranium.
When your body needs fuel, you can satisfy that itch by chomping into a big turkey.
Sandwich? Oh, I got so eager. I didn't know turkey was going to be there.
I put turkey so that you'd know that it was, you know, sandwich. Yeah.
I didn't have it until turkey. So. The topic for the day is fuel. And I do love I love human fuel. Human fuel is one of my very favorite things in the whole world. Mm-hmm. It's so good. It's wonderful that we need it to survive, but also, I guess it's not really a coincidence. It's really good to do to get it into you. It's one of the best things.
Sometimes cooking it really sucks, but you know.
Sometimes that's bad, but sometimes that's fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, fuel. Sari, what is fuel?
So fuel, as far as I can define, drawing these lines somewhere, is a material that can be broken up or react with other substances so that it releases some form of energy. So that's like solid fuels like wood or coal or food that you eat and then digest, liquid fuels like petroleum or
Gatorade.
Yeah, or Gatorade. gaseous fuels like natural gas, propane, the gas from the Cheese Whiz can that you're spraying in your mouth. I don't know if you actually turn that into energy. That's probably just a propellant, isn't it?
Yeah. Don't suck on the gas from the Cheese Whiz. That's actually bad. Not allowed.
Yeah. Okay. Do not take. I was trying to think of a gas.
I don't think that we get energy from any gases. Unfortunately, it'd be really cool to be able to eat some air.
The stuff you get from oxygen, like oxygen doesn't count.
Oxygen is not a fuel. It is necessary for the oxidation and combustion that turns the fuel into energy. But it doesn't, well, I mean,
that's where it gets
interesting.
Uh-huh.
Interesting, actually, because part of the energy is in the oxygen bonds, because it is a kind of unstable molecule, and it is more stable once it's CO2 and water than when it's oxygen. So kind of, I guess some of that energy gets... Now I'm very curious how much of our energy comes from oxygen.
Oh, quite a bit, I think. Even in like generating fuels and fuel cells, which we'll talk about later, but that's like oxygen is a really key part of that.
We're slappy chopping this guy all up. Nothing's nothing.
Well,
I thought we had it. I thought it was easy, but now I'm like, oxygen is not a fuel. More is it?
Things that are not fuels, like a capacitor, something that stores electrical
energy.
Yeah. A ball on a hill, which has potential energy, but it's not a fuel. It rolls down.
It's not a fuel.
It's not a fuel.
But that's not chemical. It needs to be chemical?
No, because nuclear energy is not technically chemical. And that's fuel. Sure.
I guess, because we've expanded. Uranium is technically the fuel.
Yes. We'll
probably call it fuel pellets. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's extending the idea of a fuel to an analogous thing.
Yeah.
I think that if I'm going to be pedantic, fuel pellets are not fuel in the same way an uphill ball is not fuel, or like the water in a dam is not fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm in trouble later then.
Quick, Sam, research a new fact.
So, Sari, do you know where the word fuel comes from? Or got any etymologies for me?
I do. I have a couple of them for you. So it comes from the classical Latin word focalia, which means brushwood for fuel, from the Latin focalis, which means pertaining to a hearth, which comes from focus, which means a hearth or a fireplace. And so focus, a point of convergence or like the focal point of anything, was a fireplace because it was the center of the home. So it's like,
that's amazing.
That's our focus over there. It's got that wood burning in it.
That's so cool. That's interesting that we had a word for that before we had a word for the stuff we burned in it.
And then we like took the word for the stuff we burned of like, oh, I guess we need something. Fuel. Fuel's in
fuel
the
for the
fire.
Fuel.
Yeah.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, sir.
You know, gamer fuel is
the drink, the energy drink?
Yeah. Is caffeine a fuel?
No. Caffeine would not be a fuel.
Okay.
It doesn't actually provide you energy. It just increases the metabolism somehow. Caffeine works turns out to be very complicated. Yeah. It's a stimulant.
So it affects your hormones as opposed to being converted into energy itself.
They got to change their name then.
Well, I think they also put a bunch of sugar in, so they're probably good.
Oh, okay.
That is technically fuel. And that means that it's time to move on to the next portion of our show, the quiz portion of our show. We're going to be playing Fuel Truth or Fail. Humans have been using fuel to power everything from our lights to our transportation for an awful long time, and our reliance on fuel has forced us into strange situations and adaptations. The following are three stories of our dependence on different types of fuel, but only one of them is true. Which one is it? Round number one. In the early 19th century, the price of candles suddenly dropped due to an exceptionally successful whale hunt. While the reason for the success was unknown at the time, scientists reading logs from the whale hunts have since hypothesized that the whales were easy to isolate and kill due to a parasitic infection.
Hmm.
Or it might be the second fact. In the early days of gas stations in the 20th century, consumers were concerned that the gasoline they were putting in their cars would be dirty or contaminated with other molecules. So local newspapers began to send a reporter out every morning to every gas station to do a write-up on the quality of the gas of that day. Or it could be fact number three. Recently, to cut down on fuel costs, ships have begun using a technology that creates millions of tiny bubbles for them to float on. This carpet made of bubbles cuts down on resistance between the body of the ship and the water around it so that the ship can move more efficiently overall.
Oh.
So, is it whale parasites driving down the cost of candles, newspapers including a daily gas report on the molecules in the gas, or ships blowing bubbles to be more fuel efficient?
Gosh. The ship blowing bubble is a good idea.
I mean, if it works.
Real. But we got a patent on our hands, I think. But I think I feel like some animal does that, and I've heard of it, maybe the bubble thing.
That's what I was thinking too. I know we're not supposed to help each other, but I'm pretty sure it's a snail.
Let's be friends today.
Okay.
Sorry. Let's try to tie.
Okay.
You're going for a tie?
Let's do it. Let's try to tie. Let's try to be equally witty and smart.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Then I'm pretty sure the bubbles are a snail. They like bubble up. The way that bubbles keep their form is by excreting a mucus, and then they like create these little bubble rafts so they can float along the ocean.
What if you're trying to trick me?
I agreed.
Oh, wow.
Oh, God.
Yeah, a virtual handshake.
They're shaking hands.
Yeah.
All right.
We're in the video. Okay. This is why I did the bit.
That was a weird thing because you both used the same hand. So you'd just be sort of like holding your hand next to each other.
Well, still, we can hold hands to seal the deal too. That's a very yeah. tender way to do
it. A newspaper gas report sounds just stupid enough to be something that would
that's
be
what
like,
I was thinking. Yeah, I would love if I do not want to go into journalism. If journalism involved going to test the gas molecules and writing about it, I think I would do journalism. I would just show up to my local gas station and be like, hello, I'm here to check your molecules.
Squirt some gas in your mouth and squish it around.
Yeah, like a little
my question.
Box.
How do they do it? Do you just give it a sniff? You're like, that smells right.
I think
love
the
that.
Secret is it doesn't matter how they do it because they can just right. say that it's this looks great or this looks yep. terrible. Yep. Maybe get a little money on the side, you know?
The whale parasites and candles. I don't know. I know whale oil was a big thing. And I know sure. there was a time where whale oil like significantly disrupted the economy, I think, because we realized that we could get oil from whales instead of oil from other sources. And like that's what made it easier. So it was like a one-to-one replacement as opposed to replacing candles, which is like a separate source of light and heat.
I guess this is dependent on somebody being really interested in why. In candle prices a long time ago and being like, mystery is afoot. Is that what it is? Like somebody looked into it way later and was like, why are these candles so cheap?
Well, no, I think that like that shocks like that are pretty well documented in the time. But then the idea is that scientists were able to go back and figure out what caused the shock, sort of like the root cause of it.
Which is a parasite as opposed to just whaling in general.
Right. Yeah, as opposed to just like a bumper crop of big marine mammals. You guys are trying to tie, so you don't actually have to think about this. You have to guess the same thing, and the outcome will be the same whether you get it right or wrong.
Yeah,
that's
so
no fun.
You have kind of ruined the fun by your cooperative nature of gameplay.
I'm going to guess the newspaper gas reports. I was leaning towards newspaper that before our report. Conversation, okay. So.
Okay, I'll go with that one too.
It didn't matter. It was the thing. You were both wrong anyway, because it was the bubbles.
Oh, no.
What?
The bubbles.
That one
so
was...
some ships, including cruise lines, are sailing on bubble carpets, and the technology is called air lubrication. You're right about the snails. That's a real thing. You didn't make that up.
I was like, what a tale you've woven for me.
Yeah.
For what end?
For what end? So it reduces the friction between the ships and the ocean. In one version of the lubrication setup, there's a blower that blows bubbles continuously at different points along the bottom of the ship's hull. While one company estimates that the air lubrication technology can reduce fuel consumption by 5 to 10%, there are some limitations. The ships have to be traveling relatively quickly, and it likely won't accomplish much in rough seas. So it's sort of more useful for faster moving ships, which is maybe a smaller portion of the average number of ships out there. But yeah, there are real things here. Early gas pumps had a little cylinder where you could actually see the gas that was getting pumped into your tank. So you could look at it and be like, that looks good by my expert eye. I don't know why I know. In the first fact about the whale parasites was loosely inspired by a flu pandemic in 1872 that infected horses and mules. And this is like, it feels quite reminiscent of the problems that we have these days because it was a horse and mule problem, but it became a coal problem because the horses and mules were used to move around coal at coal mines. And with the lack of horses to use to move coal around, coal prices went up because of the flu pandemic. So there was it sounds familiar, right? You get these disruptions that are sort of second order and third order effects that are like, oh, there was like some horses got sick and now people are cold.
Wow.
Which is a bummer.
That's
but,
wild.
No bumper crop. Of and also mostly I think whale oil is used in as a liquid fuel, not as a solid one.
Necessary, I was saying. Yeah. No whale candles.
So we're moving into the break with a 0-0 tie as they wanted. We'll be back in a second.
I regret it now.
So SciShow Tangents is brought to you by Rocket Money, a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. As you know, Tangents is a show about science. With that in mind, I've gone out into the field to do some personal research for this ad. Join me as I observe in his natural habitat, the money dummy, a lowly creature who lacks the natural ability to know how many subscription services he's even subscribed to.
Ah, another beautiful day being a money dummy without a care in the world. I'm one of the 75% of people who have subscription services that I've forgotten about, just sucking away at my bank account like a tick on a deer. But that's okay with me. Who needs extra money? Now to just have a drink from this pond. Gulp, gulp,
gulp. Rawr!
Oh, no.
Dear Lord, there was a money smarty in that pond, laying in wait for the hapless money dummy. Why, she's devoured him whole.
Foolish money dummy. I, the money smarty, use that extra money to become a deadly predator and get the drop on you. But here's my dark secret. I used to be a money dummy, too. Evolution happened real fast, I guess. That is, until I used Rocket Money to find and cancel my unwanted subscriptions and cancel the ones I didn't want. Then I used Rocket Money to monitor my spending and build budgets until I became the impressive specimen you see today. And I'm not alone. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. And if you had gotten Rocket Money, money dummy, you'd be a money smarty too, instead of my dinner.
That's really interesting. Too bad I didn't know.
And so the beauty and horror of nature laid bare. And what did we learn? How about to stop wasting your money on things you don't use? Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/tangents. That's rocketmoney.com/tangents. rocketmoney.com/TANGENTS. Welcome back, everybody. It's time to get ready for the Fact Off. Our panelists have brought science facts to present to me in an attempt to blow my mind. And after everyone has presented their facts, I will judge them and award Hank Bucks any way I see fit. But to decide who goes first, I have a trivia question for you. The first liquid-fueled rocket was successfully launched on March 16th, 1926 by the physicist Robert H. Goddard. Goddard's first launch only went 41 feet into the air, but he believed that rockets like that rocket might one day travel to outer space. However, there were plenty of skeptics, including the New York Times editorial board. In 1920, the newspaper published an anonymous op-ed titled "A Severe Strain on Credulity," which argued that a rocket cannot travel in the vacuum of space because there isn't air to push against.
Oh, okay.
Of course, even the New York Times makes mistakes, and they did eventually publish a correction. How many years did it take for them to make that correction?
Space stuff was like the 1960s.
Yeah, there was a lot of space stuff going on in the
1960s. I feel like that was it. I'm going to say 40, 42.
Sam, what do you got? What do you think?
1951.
So you're going to make me do math now, 1929. Uh-oh. So that's 22 years. All right, Sari is the winner. And indeed, the correction was published on July 17th, 1969, which you may recognize as the day after the Apollo 11 launch.
Yeah, they really ate it.
Yeah, that was not, by the way, the first time space happened. Space rockets did a number of things before then, but I think somebody sort of pointed it out to them and were like, hey, it's a pretty big deal going on right now. You wrote this in the 20s and you might want to say sorry. To quote the original editorial, that Professor Goddard, with his, quote, chair in Clark College and the countenancing of the Smithsonian Institution, does not know the relation of action to reaction and of the need to have something better than a vacuum with which to react. Of course, he only seems to lack the knowledge ladled out daily in high schools. Boy, I'm glad that this person was anonymous, because otherwise they would have had
like
to deal with that forever.
Ding-dong.
Well,
yeah. What a ding.
Yeah, the problem is people still would write. I could see that being written
yeah.
nowadays,
yeah.
Not anonymously. They just got away with it back in the day.
From the correction,
It says, further investigation and experimentation have confirmed the findings of Isaac Newton in the 17th century, and it is now definitely established that a rocket can function in a vacuum as well as in an atmosphere. The Times regrets the error.
Did they not mention the Apollo 11 launch at all?
No, they did.
Okay, they did. Good. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that means that Sari gets to decide who goes first.
Sam, you can go first.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Of all the things in the universe that use fuel, cars is one of them. And they use a lot of it. In 2020, in America alone, cars used about 123 billion gallons of gas. And this gas, well, it's not so good for planet Earth. Gases like carbon dioxide are expelled in car exhaust that make their way to the atmosphere, causing all sorts of climate changey issues. You all know this. Of course, there are cars that exist today that don't use gasoline as fuel, but use electricity instead. However, that electricity has to come from somewhere, and more often than not, it's coming from power plants that also expel greenhouse gases. You simply can't win. But back in the late 50s, when plastic was allowing for unprecedented convenience in people's day-to-day lives, and everyone was expecting jetpacks and hover cars any minute, automobile engineers were playing around with using a new fuel source in cars, one that's clean, long-lasting, dependable, and could allow for thousands of miles of travel on a single tank. And that fuel source was a nuclear reactor.
I mean, it's fun idea. It's a fun, like, I don't know that I want every single American to have some uranium, but it's a fun idea.
Well, we might not have to have uranium. I'll get to that in the end.
Okay.
By 1958, nuclear energy, which had, as many things do, started out as a terrible weapon, had been harnessed for power generation all over the world, powering cities and even some vehicles like nuclear submarines. And it was going pretty well. So the next logical step was putting one in every car in America, or at least that's what some scientists at Ford thought when they mocked up the nuclear-powered Ford Nucleon in 1958. This concept car, which basically looks like a sporty version of the Homer from the episode of The Simpsons where Homer designs a car called the Homer, was only ever made in non-functioning model form, but would have featured a replaceable uranium-powered nuclear reactor that would get you about 5,000 miles before it needed to be swapped out.
That's pretty good.
And
not
but bad.
Like, not as far as I kind of expected it to, honestly.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you a little bit more about that later also. And it had another advantage that they maybe weren't thinking about too much at the time. I'm not really sure, but sounds pretty good to us these days, since nuclear energy is basically like a steam engine, except with a big chunk of eternally hot rock making the steam spin turbines or whatever. It didn't make the same carbon dioxide heavy exhaust that your standard gas guzzling car does.
Wait, so this was a steam powered car?
Yeah.
So they... Okay, I would have assumed that it would be electric, but that's
well, there
wild.
there was like a steam thing in there that was spinning a turbine to make electricity.
Oh, to make electricity,
which was
so it didn't actually like the steam didn't like connect to the wheels.
No, but that was the problem with the car because the steam nature of the nuclear power was also the thing that made the Nucleon impossible, basically. Because in a regular car, you turn gas into an explosion of mechanical energy.
Yeah, there's a problem here.
And then the Nucleon, you turn the thermal energy into mechanical energy into electricity. And the equipment to do that made the car really heavy with a huge area taken up by the engine. Like 60% or 70% of the car is just like a huge engine. And the car was even huger because the reactor would always be making heat, I think. So it was covered in exhaust vents that would just spit out really hot air all the time, even when you weren't driving it.
I hate this more and more all the time.
Is to mention all of the extremely heavy shielding required to protect everyone in the vicinity from deadly radiation.
And I'm sure that these things would never get in car accidents.
What would happen if they did? Just like...
Well, the shielding may be compromised, which I don't love.
Bad. They wouldn't explode, though, right?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that the way that it sounds like this works, it isn't a meltdownable thing.
So a real working version of the Ford Nucleon never saw the light of day, but science is always marching on. And there are apparently several companies working on nuclear cars these days. And some 60 odd years of research and development has changed a lot. And these days, nuclear cars in development are powered by thorium, which is an element with a more controllable reaction than uranium. And they shoot it, the thorium, with a laser. And that makes the thorium make heat in a pressurized steam chamber that spins a turbine. And all of this happens in a 500-pound engine, which is about the same as an engine in like a gas-powered car. And it's been speculated that 8 grams of thorium could power your car for 300,000 miles. So
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Because like a nuclear powered aircraft carrier, like 20 years between refuelings. And I'm like, that's what I want.
Yes.
I do not want anything to be involved. If I'm going to be using a thorium powered laser activated nuclear reactor in my car, I don't ever want to have to go to the gas station. Like, yeah. I'm done. It's the life of the car. Thank you.
My kids will be driving this car. No problem.
Yeah. I want a laser car. I want a Nucleon. It looks great.
Maybe we could have laser planes, thorium planes, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Then trained professional has to operate them.
Exactly. It's not like some stranger is just buying one of these at a used car lot.
Yeah, and putting like offensive bumper stickers on the back of it.
Yeah. I wouldn't like it if there was like a really scary bumper sticker on the back of a nuclear powered car.
Yeah.
I'd be like, I don't think I want to live in this country anymore. But, you know, airlines are very regulated already. And no one's ever stolen an airplane, right? Ever.
That's
never happened.
Oh, okay.
All right, Sari, I feel good about Sam's fact.
Okay.
But what do you have?
So it's fairly easy to confuse fuel cells with batteries because their basic structures are similar, or at least it was for me. There's two electrodes called an anode and a cathode separated by an electrolyte that allows ions to move. And the main difference...
Gatorade.
Yeah, it's just pure Gatorade.
Your car is very thirsty. Please top her off.
And the main difference, in my understanding, is that batteries have all their chemical reactions contained inside them, whether you can rearrange ions to recharge the batteries or not. But on the other hand, fuel cells need a constant stream of fuel to the anode and oxygen to the cathode for the chemical reactions to happen and the electrical current to be generated. And the most common fuel you hear about with fuel cells is hydrogen gas. But there's a lot of exploratory research these days to investigate fuel cells that run on different substances like glucose or lignin or other weird innovations. But I'm not here to talk about those, as cool and weird as they are. Instead, I want to present a fuel cell hiding right under our noses in breathalyzers.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, isn't it weird? I'm glad you don't know about this already, because I didn't, and I was going to feel like I had egg on my face if you did, if everyone was like, well,
I mean, obviously. You have a little bit of egg on your face because I was a lignin chemist in college. And so anything to do with lignin, I'm like, you win! No one ever talks about lignin.
Damn. Okay, well, let me just
keep that in mind for the future.
Eureka alert this article again. Because it's kind of invasive to sample some blood to calculate blood alcohol content, breath analyzer technologies have been around since at least the early 1900s. As you know, the alcohol we drink is just ethanol, and chemists know how ethanol reacts in predictable ways. So an early breath analyzer was developed in the 1930s by a biochemist named Rolla N. Harder, and he called it the drunkometer.
Wait, was his name Rolla Harder?
Harder?
Yeah, Rolla Harder would have been great. It's just like, yes, that is a man who parties right there.
And so it worked by you blew into a balloon, and then the balloon was hooked up to a machine, and then the machine pushed the air through and reacted the ethanol in someone's breath with a potassium permanganate solution, and the gas turned more and more purple with more and more ethanol. So you just like looked at how purple it was, and I'm like, they're kind of drunk.
That's a fine drunkometer, but that's not nearly as cool as what's coming next.
Yeah. The next big advancement was in the 1950s by Robert Frank Borkenstein. Great name also.
Also a partier.
Really yeah.
That's everybody like, hey, Bobby Borkenstein. Bobby, Bork.
And so Bobby Bork took advantage of the fact that ethanol is a perfectly good fuel that can be used by a fuel cell to generate electricity, which is how the first breathalyzer worked. So you blew into the device, and if there was enough ethanol in your breath, then it would chemically react with the anode, power the fuel cell, and generate an electric current. And more ethanol means a stronger current because there's more fuel in the cell, which then can be mathematically translated to an estimate of your blood alcohol content.
Whoa, what the hell?
Yeah. And so you can still get fuel cell breathalyzers that work like this. A lot of the ones that are like casually on the market for people are fuel cell breathalyzers, although there are also much fancier ones, devices that use spectroscopy to more precisely analyze the molecules in your mouth. And there are so many other better ways to generate electricity with your body, like pedaling on a bike or eating food and just letting your body do its thing. But I guess drinking alcohol and breathing it in a mini fuel cell is one of them, which is so weird.
I mean, ethanol is a fuel. You put it into a fuel cell, you generate electricity with your drunkenness. Is it enough to like shock me? This is what I want
to
know.
I don't think so. It's enough to power the device if you do it regularly enough.
Oh yeah, it charges itself.
Yeah, it charges itself. I think if.
But like, if you blew into a thing and it had a little electrode at the end of it, you couldn't go and electrocute people.
I bet it would be
milliamps.
Small, yeah. Maybe you can maybe make their tongue feel a little. So if you blew into one end,
it's like,
and then
a 9-volt
someone else
battery.
Yeah, a 9-volt battery, like a little sour on the other end of it.
So I think that Sari convinced you to go in on a Thai salmon. It's come to bite you in the butt because Sari has taken away the episode. Though I loved yours as well.
I think your decision is flawed, but that's okay. I want to argue.
Yeah, no. This is totally understandable about having a group of people who are working together, is that you're not always going to agree, but as long as you understand the reasoning behind the decision, we can move forward.
It's going to take some time.
It's time to move on to the next segment, Ask the Science Couch, where we've got some listener questions for our finely honed couch of scientific minds. What sort of research, James from Discord asks, has been done on chlorophyll-based solar power? What a great question. So I guess the idea being chlorophyll turns sunlight into fuel, lignin, and cellulose and stuff that you can burn.
The face you made when you said lignin.
Any chance to mention lignin?
Yeah.
and that is electrons moving around. Like, is a lot of how that happens. So why not? It would be nice to do with plants because they're made out of carbon dioxide rather than out of a bunch of heavy metals and silicon and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's what I know. Sari, what do you know?
I'm just going to take what you said, basically, and string it into the narrative order that I pre-crafted for the episode, but try not to repeat as much. So solar cells, the way that they work is by capturing sunlight to generate electricity. And so in a photovoltaic cell, like Hank was mentioning, it's usually a semiconductor like silicon, which... just the sunlight hits it, and then electrons get excited or get popped out in some way, and then those electrons like become electricity. Vaguely similar with chlorophyll. Electron gets excited, it absorbs sunlight, electrons get excited, and then get moved around in photosystems 1 and 2 within a plant. And so like that's the piece that we would replace, is like, okay, instead of a semiconductor, what happens if we put in chlorophyll? And even though it sounds good on face value, the problem with it is the limitations of chlorophyll. Like, it did not evolve to capture the most energy possible. Chlorophyll only absorbs light within the visible spectrum, whereas like semiconductors can absorb light more broadly. There's still flaws in semiconductors. So like silicon, for example, absorbs most in like the infrared red part of the spectrum and less at higher levels. Mm-hmm. And like some energy gets wasted as heat gets converted to heat instead of electricity. But chlorophyll is like a very specialized molecule, a very specialized set of molecules that can only absorb certain kinds of light. And it's not as efficient as a solar cell, like an artificial solar cell that we've created, because plants, they absorb a ton of energy, but then dump it out a lot to avoid like toxic chemical reactions. So they are intentionally inefficient so that the plants can survive and don't get like overwhelmed with molecules or chemical
free
processes
radicals
or not free radicals. Yeah, mostly free radicals from the oxygen.
Electrons jumping around and doing stuff to their DNA and stuff.
Yeah. So they want to avoid mutations. And so they don't want to absorb too much energy, whereas the goal with a solar panel is to absorb as much energy as possible. So that has made plants evolutionarily a little bit inefficient. But I think in all this, a lot of the discussion is like, well, what if we change chlorophyll? What if we like put in a different, swap out atoms in chlorophyll so that it can absorb a spectrum more broadly? And also, what if we figure out how to modify like the photo systems themselves, like other things that the chlorophyll interacts with. But that would just take a lot more work. And we are maybe starting to head down that path, but also, I don't know. Chlorophyll's good at making food and silicon's good at making solar panels. So the path of least resistance is continuing that.
But also maybe we get better at making food this way. And like we have, instead of making electricity, you just make sugar with it. And then you do things to make sugar. That would be a big level up for humanity.
Maybe you answered this, but could we just get like real mad science-y and make like the perfect sun absorbing plant?
So we would have to modify the chlorophyll molecules themselves.
The leaves would be black, which is interesting.
Once you get past the, okay, I'm going to modify chlorophyll as a pigment, there are so many interfacing systems that you'd have to also modify to like make the plant grow into what you want it to grow and make sure you don't like break all that in the way that we don't know how to change someone's eye color. Like we're not at Gattaca yet for human DNA.
Yeah, but we couldn't just start now and be like, I'm going to take this plant and put it next to this plant and they'll make a slightly better one. And then we'll just like in a few hundred years, we'll have like the perfect one.
Well, you're not. So if you're trying to make electricity, plants don't really make electricity in the way that we can, that we could capture it. So what you'd need is you need to engineer it to not just have like awesome black leaves that capture all the energy, but also wires to move it. So that, which would be tricky, but not, I mean, not impossible. Like science fiction world, like 400, 500 years from now, I could totally see growing a plant that has that, like you plug, you could like plug in.
Put your phone around it.
Plug your phone right into it.
Bacteria do make like electrical filaments, which is very, very weird. There are some bacteria that just like make these
conducting filaments.
Yeah. And just make them all around. So like maybe combining a plant and a bacteria, then it just will grow some wires instead of roots. And then you just,
there's no reason you can't grow a wire. Like it is a feasible thing to do with carbon chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Robot plants.
I'm sure nothing bad would ever happen because we it would all be fine.
Yeah, I'm sure that there wouldn't be some fungus that would eat all of the power generating plants on Earth.
Yeah.
And end it all for everyone. Well, if you want to ask the Science Couch your question, you can follow us on Twitter at SciShow Tangents, where we'll tweet out topics for upcoming episodes every week. Or you can join the SciShow Tangents Patreon and ask us on Discord. Thank you to Totally Not a Chris on Discord, at Mooney Riot, and everybody else who asked us your questions for this episode. If you like this show and you want to help us out, it's very easy to do that. You can go to patreon.com/SciShowTangents and become a patron, where you can get access to things like our newsletter and our bonus episodes. And as I say frequently, we can't do this without our patrons. Second, you can leave us a review wherever you listen. It also has helped us, by the way, create our video episodes, which are on YouTube and are a joy, and you get to see some of the things we're talking about. Second, you can leave us a review wherever you listen. That helps us know what you like about the show. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just
tell people about us.
Thank you for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
And I've been Sam Schultz.
SciShow Tangents is created by all of us and produced by Sam Schultz, who edits a lot of these episodes, along with Seth Glicksman. Our story editor is Alex Billow. Our social media organizer is Paola Garcia Prieto. Our editorial assistants are Deboki Chakravarti and Emma Dowster. Our sound design is by Joseph Tuna Medish. Our executive producers are Caitlin Hoffmeister and me, Hank Green. And of course, we couldn't make any of this without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you. And remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire.
But one more thing. Humans have been burning dried animal dung as fuel for thousands of years, but nowadays, reusing our very own butt excretions is more common than you might think.
Okay. Don't say that.
Is that what that is?
Yeah. Okay. Millions of gallons of human waste around the world gets fed to anaerobic bacteria who help process it into a mixture of gases called biomethane, aka renewable natural gas. And biomethane can be used for things like heating, generating electricity, or fueling vehicles, from fleets of dump trucks to modified Volkswagen Beetles, which are cheekily called dung beetles.
Did you pick dump trucks because of dumps also?
Yeah.
I was like trying to spice up this fact as much as possible because it's kind of generic, you know, but I wanted to say some funny
dump
words.
Trucks.
Yeah.